Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I must first apologize. Me and Michael Morris are a little bit under the weather. We both have various throat and sinus problems, so we sound a little bit low energy today or a little bit funny. It's because of that. I'm joined, of course, today by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
Well, I was about to say very well. It's a sort of habitual response, I suppose. Pretty well on the whole. For fine in spirit, if not necessarily in the flesh, but soldiering on. Nice to see you both again.
And we also have Mr. Terence Cargan here.
Hey, Nicholas, and hello to all of those out there in the audience again. See Moon Dancer, Vutsako, 1-4, and Lady Di so far.
Great stuff.
Very good to see you all. And welcome very much as well, Terence. So before we get started, let me just quickly read a word from our sponsor, Hideco Energy. Hideco Energy says, are you tired of skyrocketing energy bills, electricity bills, and the new phenomenon of load reduction? Meet Hideco Energy, South Africa's trusted Tier 1 premium solar and backup power solution supplier. With over 100 years of trading experience and the backing of a publicly listed company, Hideco Energy brings you the best quality international products to power your home or business reliably. From 3-kilowatt single-phase systems to 250-kilowatt three-phase solutions, we've got options for every need. And here's the best part. We offer unbeatable financing and rent-to-own packages designed to lower the barriers to saving money, cutting electricity costs, and ensuring power stability, regardless of what's happening at Eskom. Right now, they're thrilled to offer Daily Friend listeners an exclusive promotion. You can book a free business or household audit, and they'll show you how to put more money back in your pocket without hefty upfront costs. Reach out to sales at hidecoenergy.co.za or call them on 011-447-9864. Hideco Energy, sustainable power and storage solutions. And we will put the link to that in the show notes and on the description on YouTube. Okay. Let us talk about our first story of today, and this is that the Department of Trade and Industry under Minister Parks Tau is kicking around the idea of establishing a 100 billion rand fund to exclusively assist black businesses, and the private sector must contribute if they do not want to be penalized. The idea is to take, as far as I understand, so currently to qualify for BEE, if you want to qualify for BEE, you need to contribute the equivalent of 3% of annual net profits after tax for the development of black suppliers. Seems like the idea here is to take that money that the private sector is giving already and funnel it into a central government-controlled fund. Now, I was a little bit confused when I was reading some of the details of the story, so I apologize if I've gotten any details there wrong, but that does seem to be the gist of it. And this was criticized heavily. This came to light after a parliamentary question asked by the DA MP, Toby Chance, who heavily criticized this. It was also criticized by the CEO of Sakalika, Pete LaRue, who said, the idea behind it is to give the ANC control over the money to sustain itself in power, as well as apply direct engineering to the economy. What would be particularly harmful is not even how the money will be wasted, but two other issues. Firstly, it will expropriate up to 3% of post-tax profits of companies and thereby reduce real economic productivity accordingly. Secondly, it makes black people servants of the ANC and the state, because a central fund like this breaks the multitude of direct relationships that otherwise exist and will arise between white to black and black to black business people, if money must first flow through the state before it counts as empowerment. So, Terence, let me start with you. There was some sort of buzz, I think we even mentioned a few times on the show, that Parks Tau would be a more reasonable voice than the previous occupants of the Department of Trade and Industry. But it seems to me as though, as you said in the pre-show discussion, this is just lots of doubling down on a lot of really bad ideas of the ANC.
Words sort of fail me about what a bad idea this is. But you know, we haven't seen any evidence, or very little evidence, I'm afraid, since the election. In fact, everything that the ANC does seems to be premised on the idea that they are the largest party, and they can sort of carry on with it with their agenda, and everyone must sort of fall in. I rather get the sense that the orientation is that their real opposition remains the DA, and the GNU is effectively about demonstrating who's boss. But look, this is in sort of raw economic terms, assuming that this isn't some sort of new tax. And be very careful, because if this seeks to displace what certain players, you know, are now receiving as what they might believe is an entitlement, there's going to be a hell of a stink about that. So, you know, maybe this is, well, you know, we'd like this as well as, you know, whatever you're doing now. I think it unfortunately speaks to the sort of split personality or just raw economic illiteracy of the government. Peter Bruce actually did a very good piece last week, I think it was, where he was talking about the new employment regulations. And you know, I've had a businessman tell me that at the end he simply cannot function in South Africa anymore. And this is a, you know, firm that provides, you know, high paying manufacturing jobs, supposedly ticking every box that government policy is about. But yeah, you know, there is only so much that you can expropriate before the incentive to do anything at all just collapses. Before, you know, maybe you just want to sell the carcass for whatever you can, put the money in, make sure you trust them, live out your days like that, or decamp abroad. But South Africa is not an easy place to do business in. It's not an easier attractive investment destination. And if you keep on piling these demands on, it just becomes ever more less so. And I think, you know, the problem is that just sets us up for, you know, that much more decline before either we hit rock bottom and there's some sort of structural adjustment program needed, or, you know, we start the process of trying to climb out of this, which I've said before is the work of a decade, if not a generation.
Yeah, Michael, I think the thing that annoys me the most about this is it's so obviously about control. It's not about helping Black South Africans. You know, there's this kind of story of, oh no, we need to direct the funds correctly in the right direction. We all know from so many examples in government's recent history of what exactly is going to happen, which is that some of this will be stolen and some of this will be directed, if not all of it, will be directed towards party-affiliated cadres. It will be inefficient. It will be corrupt. And very little will actually be done to help South Africans who desperately might need finance. This is all the worst things of kind of ANC policy all bundled together. It's racializing the distribution of resources. It's centralizing decision-making and power. It's just a terrible idea. And the very people that it's purporting to kind of maybe help, which is, you know, entrepreneurial poor Black South Africans, are almost certainly to be the people who will suffer the most from this kind of policy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it actually penalizes entrepreneurialism, which is ironic. Just a couple of points. I fully agree with 144, who writes here that one would think in 30 years of failed policy, one would change direction, but maybe the policies haven't failed in terms of as the ANC sees them. And I think, as Terence says, we're looking at an instance of chronic economic illiteracy. Something that we've, I think, argued for years, and the IRR on the show as well, that, you know, the most transformative thing any South African can do is to succeed. A successful individual, a successful business is enormously and substantively transformative. And what one kind of has a sense of here with you know, the ANC coming along with this in 2025, which it begs belief really so late in the day that they still hammering on with these failed ideas and these tired and exhausted sort of concepts, is as a kind of perhaps a sense of panic in the party, the ruling party, that it has actually failed, that its policies are not working, that more and more people are losing their jobs, are not being able to find jobs, businesses are struggling. The story that Terence tells, eventually it just gets too much. If you continue adding that burden, it becomes untenable, and very rational and economically sound decisions lead to businesses actually leaving the country. So it really is a bad idea on a number of levels. It weakens that most important thing in any free society, which is the agency of individuals who feel that they have a stake and can exploit the stake they have, make their own choices, succeed as well as they choose to succeed without impediment. And that really is what transformation is. And I think maybe the final point to make is how terribly patronizing of Black business people. Is the ANC really suggesting that they are so ineffective and so ineffectual that they cannot just succeed? If this were said of any other kind of people in society, they'd be an absolute outcry. It really is just an absolutely absurd proposition, and terribly, terribly patronizing, I think. We've seen the successes that occur despite all these impediments. And the costs in the converse of kind of imposing regulation and trying to socially engineer a result at as you say it, Nicholas, the cost of the way people it's meant to benefit.
Right. If the ANC's goal was truly to see Black businesses in this country as it defines it succeed in this country, what would be the best way? It would be to maybe lower the taxes that we have to pay, and that make it difficult to expand your business or grow your income or invest. It would be to deregulate parts of the economy that are way overregulated. It would be to improve the education system. There are so many ways that government could make life easier for all business people, which would by necessity end up being good for Black businesses, because Black South Africans, of course, make up the vast majority of the country. Yeah. But this centralized direction of funds is just going to be another orgy of stealing and corruption and mismanagement. We've seen so many times before. Terence, any final thoughts on this one?
Yeah, look, okay. First of all, let me just acknowledge my sin. It's 1 of 44. Right. Okay. That having been done, look, let me just say that I think that what you're dealing with is a phenomenon that's been identified elsewhere, that racially defined support in this way, or the designation of state administered economic benefits to a particularly ascriptively described group, is politically useful. Because it invariably accrues to a small group of the politically connected, often those in the least need of help. But it also undermines, and we've seen this in places like Malaysia, it undermines real competitiveness, because people can get addicted to those to those legs up. You can call on the state to help you out when you're not able to compete. Effective solutions, as you say, tax rate. I mean, I've got an idea. I wonder if you couldn't give like a 5 or even a 10 year tax holiday to people setting up businesses and townships. It doesn't matter whether you're a Korean or a Zimbabwean or from Katlehong. You in this area, it's tax free, whatever. Health and safety regulations, but that's pretty much it. We want you to we want entrepreneurship to flourish. We don't want people having to spend 3 hours to get to and from work. If you're lucky enough to have a job, once you'll walk down the road and there's your work right there. And it doesn't matter who you are. But the problem is that wouldn't be politically directed. It doesn't create the sort of little the sluices and the gates that allow certain people in and keep certain people out. If you want an example of this, remember when the Chinese were included as Black, there was a hell of an outcry about that, because these Chinese people are going to come and take something that's mine. And there was, you know, some dreadful ethnocentricity that China, that blacks don't speak blacks don't speak Chinese, they speak, you know, Zulu or Afrikaans or something, words to that effect, from the Minister of Labor. But yeah, you know, the point is that it does fulfill a very, it fulfills a very important economically distorting political function, and that is not going to be, that is not going to be surrendered in a hurry. And it's a sort of tax that you can, that, that that you can pass out to the, you know, to the rest of the society, whether it's poor people living in informal settlements who can't find work, or it's your, it's your tax paying base, you know, they get to, they get, they get to sit and take it.
Yeah, almost certainly the beneficiaries of this will be someone who already owns at least a couple of nice cars, unfortunately. Okay, and we'll come back to this theme in our third story, but let's quickly go to our neighbor, Mozambique. And there has been, as we talked about, a lot of unrest in the country over the disputed election there. International observers, I believe, have said that the election in Mozambique held last year, towards the end of last year, I think it was in September, was not free and fair. It's not clear whether the opposition necessarily would have won, but there's definitely a lot of distortion. The government, the governing party there, Frelimo, has ruled the country since its independence from Portugal, right through some civil wars, and let's just say it doesn't have a great democratic record. The country's been sort of teetering on the brink, lurching from one disaster to another for a while, with occasional good patches in the middle, where it seemed like things might be recovering, riddled with corruption. So it's no surprise that Mozambicans are unsatisfied with the direction of the country and have been aggressively protesting the Frelimo government. These protests were very chaotic. They were often quite violent. There was sort of rioting, property destruction. Looks like some of it spilled a little bit over into South Africa. Here and there, at one point, the South African, one of the South African border posts in Mozambique had to be closed, and the Mozambican officials actually fled into South Africa to seek protection from the protesters. The police in Mozambique were also extremely brutal on the protesters, shooting at people, clubbing people, running people over with trucks. I've seen videos of the latter of those. So it's an issue which we need to keep close attention to. And it seems like the Southern African Development Community, which is South Africa and all of the and all of our neighbors, doesn't really seem to have much of a clear idea of how to deal with this. So quite recently, the opposition leader who claims to have won the election returned to Mozambique after having fled the country initially after a mysterious assassination of another opposition politician. He called for mass protests on the day in which the Mozambican president would be sworn into office, but that he says that now they will wait and that they will engage with more protests later on. He's forming a shadow government, which he insists is the true government of Mozambique. So it seems like things have calmed down a bit there, but it's not all over yet. One of the reasons this is a big deal for South Africa is because the port of Maputo has actually been surprisingly well run despite all of Mozambique's other problems. And in fact, it's become a lifeline, particularly for South African minerals exports. According to the reporting, 53% of South Africa's chrome exports went through Maputo in 2023, and about 10% of its coal and a significant amount of a lot of minerals went through Maputo in 2024, but not all those numbers have been collected yet. Maputo is also very important for importing fuel for Zimbabwe and Malawi, two very poor countries which are also quite politically unstable. So if Mozambique became seriously disrupted, and if the port in Maputo failed, it seems like the consequences would be pretty severe for the region. Terence, your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I think that there's an interesting piece of history here that the port of Maputo has played a role in South African history going back all the way to the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republic, where Paul Kruger tried to negotiate a deal to use their ports rather than having to trek through British-controlled territory. I think there's a few things going on. First of all, South Africa cannot disentangle itself from its neighbors. And when one sneezes, you know, they all ultimately in some way catch a cold. I mean, you know, the ambitious African reform initiative that Thabo Mbeki championed at the beginning of the century fell apart because he refused to live up to those commitments in, you know, when Zimbabwe melted down. I think it's also a warning for us that you know, what happens when your institutions are not are not trusted. And we've been quite fortunate that our electoral commission is generally regarded as solid, even if there are problems. Election results are generally not seriously contested. But when you reach a point where those institutions are not trusted to adjudicate, there's very little to hold the country together. Be very, very careful of that. And I think once again, to get back to what I think ails the country, we could probably have dealt with, you know, with all the rands and cents corruption, you know, which is not rands and cents, it's billions of rands and cents, but be that as it may. I think what the corruption legacy in South Africa has been the damage to our institutions. It's been the deliberate staffing of there with political loyalists. It's been the use of policy for extraction purposes, which is my big fear about this empowerment fund, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When those things, when your system stops working, there's very little to fall back on.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's also a reminder of just how, you know, democracy is not some sort of nice to have. It does lead to stability. It does lead to a lot of, you know, positive ways of resolving political disputes. And that when people completely lose faith in it, well, they'll turn to violence, they'll turn to chaos, they'll turn to riots. And the government, if it wants to stay in power, has no choice but to use extreme violence, cruelty to keep them down. You know, once you reach the stage of Mozambique, and I think this is why as many problems as we do have with our elections, and I don't think they're in an amazing shape, certainly better than Mozambique's, and that's something we can be very thankful for. Michael, do you have any thoughts to add?
Yeah, I think certainly to reinforce Terence's point about institutions, you know, this really is very important. You can have economic growth, you can have all sorts of wonderful things happening, but if you don't have that the stability and the strength of those independent institutions in society, then you really are vulnerable to the slightest upset, to the, you know, the vagaries of history and so on. And I think you're right that we are better off, but we've got to watch it. You know, I think once that goes, the corruption does eat away at the credibility of these institutions. And once the public loses faith in them, you're on a slippery slope. There's no outside force that can come in and restore that. It's got to be a public, kind of unspoken public confidence in the way society is run. That it's believable, it's credible, it reflects their will, it's responsive, all these things. I think what we're seeing in Mozambique, and indeed, you know, the SADC's perhaps feeble response and perhaps South Africa's insufficient reaction to events there also shows that these anachronistic loyalties that are expressive of our quite sentimental sort of liberation identity is now, you know, out of date. It is anachronistic. We're living in a very different world with very different demands, all the things that both of you have spelled out, and that does require much more programmatic and engaged response from South Africa to regional issues.
So let's move on to our next story. One of the few moments in the previous election campaign, which I think there was a real substantive discussion of a policy that we had last year, was when the issue of the national minimum wage was discussed. I remember COSATU and the DA fighting in public over this. The DA basically talking about how they wanted to reform the national minimum wage, stop it raising and give grants certain exemptions. And COSATU said that this was a terrible idea, that it would impoverish everyone, and that they were just the voice of white monopoly capital or whatever. but our colleague Gabriel Krauser from IRR Legal has put out a press statement today talking a little bit about the impact that raising the national minimum wage has actually had on hundreds of thousands of people. So the National Minimum Wage Commission recently announced that it was recommending to increase the minimum wage by inflation plus an additional 1.5%. And he did some calculations that basically found that you can estimate the number of jobs that has been destroyed by the national minimum wage over the last 5 years is probably in the vicinity of 430,000. The National Minimum Wage Commission doesn't actually make an estimate itself as to how many people have lost employment opportunities, but it does admit that there is an impact, although it describes it as small. There's also a very significant amount of non-compliance. The IRR has put submissions into the National Minimum Wage to reel it in and to stop its increases because it is increasing unemployment in the country. Michael, your thoughts on the story? You know, it's actually kind of incredible how this is something that economists pretty much everywhere agree does have an impact on employment levels. And we are one of the least employed, if not the least employed countries on earth, about 40% of people without a job. And yet here we are enacting policies that very explicitly destroy jobs.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. One of the things that I felt is quite important to raise about the about Gabriel's press release and the sort of background to it is that if you look at across the media today and I think perhaps towards the end of last week even, about the National Minimum Wage Commission's statement on its intention to raise the minimum wage and its justification for doing so, it cites work done by its the economic team of experts it relies on, the Development Policy Research Unit at UCT. But as you say, the point I want to make is if you look across all the sort of media, fairly substantive media coverage of the National Minimum Wage Commission statement, you will see what it has said. It's accurately reported that they think the impact is relatively small, that there is a statistically significant effect on employment, which have been negative, and that this is chiefly in the realm of non-compliance, people not complying with minimum wage requirements. Now, the importance of organizations like the IRR is precisely expressed in what Gabriel then did with this. Is he then went back to the researchers, the Development Policy Research Unit at UCT, and quizzed them a little bit about the figures and the numbers and you know, how can we quantify this impact that they're referring to, and the initial focus was 2024. Jobs destroyed was given as 227,800, which was 3.4% of the 6.7 million low-wage workers who earn roughly up to 7,500 a month. But Gabriel then thought, well, can we look at a broader, can we see this in a kind of broader schema? And he took it back to 2019, asked them to provide figures for that. And that is where the figure of approximately 430,000 job losses over 5 years comes from. So it's really just that effort of interrogating the numbers, interrogating the statements, seeing what other detail there is, seeing, and he does it very, very carefully. He makes the point that the longer the time scale or the time horizon of this kind of research, the more likely or the more unlikely it is that you'd be able to, you know, settle on a very decided or specific figure. It's just the nature of how the economy works and how numbers work, but you can at least see a pattern, or you can at least see this broader picture. So that was one point that I thought was really important to make. And then finally, that you know, he also points out that of the submissions to the commission on its intention to raise the national minimum wage, 67% of respondents were opposed to increasing it, and only 22% favored an increase. So there's a reason for that. I think people are beginning to see that there are much more important things to steps to be taken to grow jobs, to secure jobs, to keep the jobs that people have, and enable people to go out and find jobs. And this is one measure which we now know has been actually costing jobs. And that, as the IRR says, we should take away the 25% increase, and would quite likely bring back up to 500,000 jobs that we've lost over the past 5 years.
I think it was the American economist Thomas Sowell who said the real minimum wage is zero. And I think South Africans more so probably than anywhere else really experienced that with our enormously high rates of unemployment. Terence, your thoughts?
No, look, I think this is just that empowerment fund redux, the same thinking. Minimum wages, stiff labor laws, etc., are politically useful to a particular constituency. You know, if I was a unionized worker and whatever, I'd be very much in favor of that too. Why not? That's where the government's sort of primary loyalties lie. It's effectively trying to buy off the unemployed and South Africa's desperately poor with grants and that sort of thing. The problem is that we're running out of money for all of that. Now, you know, either you can keep doubling down and pretending that, you know, as long as we just advance to the next plateau of the sunlit uplands of the National Democratic Revolution, all of this, you know, will miraculously resolve itself, because, you know, I read that at the Marx-Lenin Institute in East Berlin back in the 80s. Or, you know, you can look at your own lying eyes and see, well, you know, if I can't make enough money to hire someone, I won't hire somebody. If I can't expand, I'm not gonna hire anyone. And if it's just too damn expensive, I'll shut down. But yeah, you know, look, I do think actually there's a point to be made here, and this goes to things like preferential procurement, minimum wage, BEE. What is that actually costing? Not what are the intentions behind it, or, you know, Terence Corrigan, you are such a complete bastard because you say we must get rid of it, and that means that you're some sort of crypto fascist reactionary troglodyte son of a bitch or whatever. No, you know, actually, what is the effect? Don't worry about me. I'm fine. But yeah, you know, that it's interesting. Those questions seldom get asked. And I have said this because I've been through almost every employment equity, you know, the annual survey where you have page after page and these turgid tables that show how many disabled Indian females are employed at level 3 in manufacturing in Limpopo and whatever. Nowhere does it say why. But we get this sort of headline thing, oh, good Lord, you know, everything, we're all going to die because there's not enough, you know, things aren't arranging themselves appropriately. Well, first of all, is your assumption correct? Because nowhere in the world do you have that sort of perfect split. That is an ideological, not an empirical fact. And it doesn't matter where you can go. Whatever the history, that's just not how people sort themselves out. Secondly, well, you know, before you say, well, we just need more of this, maybe ask, is this actually helpful? If that is your outcome, is this the only way you're going to do it? Does this have collateral consequences? But you know, what a coinkydink! We just don't want to ask those questions. Well, at least I do, but people who, you know, get paid lots and lots of money to write these long turgid reports, they don't want to know that. At least I don't get the impression.
No, I think that's completely correct. Yeah, I'm always struck by ANC governance and policy always seems to be kind of just very sort of low expectations. It doesn't really believe ultimately there's lip service given to something like ending poverty, but the focus is always on, well, we'll give grant to these people and we'll soak the rich a little bit more and we'll give slightly higher minimum wages to these people and, you know, people will be able to afford one more meal a month kind of stuff. It never actually, there's very little vision for actually changing people's lives and turning the country around and making it so that South Africans have a much more hopeful future to look forward to. It's sort of very zero-sum nihilistic kind of policy making. Anyway, that is, I think,
Chinese friends for once.
Yeah. not often that I think the ANC should listen to the Communist Party of China, but economic policy might be one of the few areas where they have some points the ANC should study. Anyway, thank you for watching. We are over time, but I hope you enjoyed the show, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Wrap. Cheers, everyone.